More than 30 years ago, Iowa paperboys Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin disappeared and were never found. This hour, how those cases shattered Iowa's image as a safe place for kids. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We start off this hour by hearing from University of Iowa graduate student Paul Morzicki about the Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin cases and about the politics of child safety in the late 20th century. Then later in the hour, I talk with Special Agent Michael Motzinger of Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation about the newly formed Child Abduction Response Team. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you are of a certain age and lived in Iowa, in the Midwest, during the 1980s, the names Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin are likely to be etched in your memory. Both teenage boys disappeared while delivering newspapers in the Des Moines area. Johnny Gosch in 1982 and Eugene Martin in 1984. They were never found and are on the list of Iowa cold cases. Gosch and Martin also became the first missing youngsters featured on milk cartons. My guest this half hour is a doctoral candidate, Paul Morzicki. He's finishing up a dissertation for his PhD in the Department of History at the University of Iowa that looks at these well-known Iowa disappearances and other child abductions, disappearances across the country. He's exploring how fear developed in the 1980s around cases like Gosch's and Martin's. And in his dissertation, he also examines how the Midwest in particular reacted to the child abductions, as well as the culture of so-called milk carton kids. Paul Morzicki, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Can you elaborate a little bit on what you've been exploring in your research and writing?
Right. So my dissertation more broadly explores the politics of child safety in the late 20th century United States. And the Gosch and Martin cases were just one part or two parts of this larger story involving missing children specifically, which emerged as this consolidated issue in the early 80s and very much comported with a lot of Reagan-era policies and thinking about what types of threats confronted children. These are two cases that I situate within the Midwest and within Midwestern history, specifically at this historical juncture. But I also look at two other cases. There were the Atlanta abductions and murders, obviously in Atlanta, Georgia, in the late 70s and early 80s. And also I look at the Eton Tate's case in New York City. He disappeared in 1979 and is often remembered as the first child on milk cartons incorrectly. And that just kind of speaks to the fact that he has this very, very large role in people's ideas about child safety and missing children in the era. So more broadly, I'm looking at policy and really the politics of childhood and how notions of childhood and notions of what threats are facing children shifted during this period.
Mm-hmm. Remind us of the Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin cases briefly, if you could.
Right. So Johnny Gosch, in September 1982, goes out on his newspaper route. He's a paper boy for the Des Moines Register on a Sunday, early Sunday morning, and disappears. And there are a lot of conflicting accounts from eyewitnesses, some children and some adults who discuss a certain car that they saw or believe they saw speeding away. But really, there is very little information on what happened to him. So he more or less vanished. This was actually his first time delivering papers alone, which kind of adds to the tragedy, I suppose. And 2 years later, in pretty similar circumstances, in August 1984, Eugene Wade Martin also a paperboy for the Des Moines Register, goes out on his route and disappears in similar fashion. You know, despite their many similarities, you know, there's no explicit evidence kind of tying them together. There's no indication that the same person or persons abducted these kids. You know, we really don't know what happened to them.
Mm-hmm. Are there any leading theories about what happened to either of them?
Some folks speculate that they were recruited into a child sex ring. This is a theory that's been propagated a lot by Noreen Ghosh, Johnny's mother, who is, you know, very much at the forefront of the missing children and child safety campaigns in the early to mid-1980s, and has since gone on to really focus on sex trafficking and, you know, that specific kind of threat to children. You know, there isn't really much evidence to suggest that happened. So really, if you ask the West Des Moines Police Department, which presided over Johnny's case, or Des Moines Police Department, or DCI, they'll say they really don't know, or they have a few different theories, but really not a single kind of leading theory.
Mm-hmm. I was living in Iowa at that time as a young man, older than Johnny Ghosh or Eugene Martin. I definitely remember these cases. What did you find out about the effect these disappearances had on Iowans and our sense of Iowa, its identity as a safe place to live and raise children?
These cases very much kind of shattered those ideas in the minds of many people, even though, you know, not to minimize the tragedies, but they were two isolated incidents. You know, there were many, many paperboys. There were many, many children, many more children, obviously, than these two in Iowa at the time. And so they didn't really, you know, from, I guess, a historical vantage point, if you're looking backward, this didn't suggest a larger kind of epidemic that was sweeping Iowa. And there had been other cases of missing kids in Iowa before, and these didn't really attract the same type of attention. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what I found is that these two cases, Ghosh and Martin, really signaled to Iowans that something was wrong, and that this kind of intimated that their ideas of the Midwestern heartland as a kind of space of, you know, the editor of the Des Moines Register called it the safe and sane heartland, but that was somehow in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in correspondence to Governor Branstad, to the editor of the Des Moines Register, and, you know, in interviews, in television sources, or in the paper itself, folks are expressing this idea and saying, you know, I move my kids and I move my family here in order to be safe and kind of immune from what they considered something that should happen in other parts of the country. You know, folks are saying Iowa is not somewhere or this kind of thing doesn't happen in Iowa, right? Mm-hmm. So that very much interested me. You know, why not? Why Iowa? Why is Iowa somehow exempt from this kind of thing? So I guess to answer your question more succinctly, yeah, folks were terrified. And, you know, to put yourself in their shoes, justifiably so. I spoke with one of my mentors in the history department, and he said that he had kids on a paper route. He accompanied them shortly thereafter.
Right, right. I had two brothers who were paper boys, and soon after this, you know, you began to see fewer and fewer paper boys and girls, and you saw, I guess, adults take on this task of delivering papers, collecting papers, and delivering them very early in the morning.
Right. In the national press, and also what folks are saying, locals are saying in Iowa, is that, you know, this quintessential kind of American rite of passage for, you know, really middle-class, upper-middle-class kids is under threat, that, you know, these were, Ghosh and Martin were these all-American boys who were, you know, enterprising and, you know, out to make a buck, but also, you know, to learn certain traits, to become more self-reliant and all these things. But it was in that kind of moment that they were ostensibly abducted. And, you know, people's mind kind of wanders from there, you know, what happened to them. And so this all kind of coalesces in this kind of worldview of a Midwestern ideal in crisis, right? And it's interesting that folks are juxtaposing the Midwest and specifically the Des Moines suburbs with places like Detroit or Chicago or beyond the Midwest, Newark, right? They're saying that these types of things should happen elsewhere, that crime, these different forms of exploitation should not appear in Des Moines, which is kind of just an obfuscation of fact. You know, there is crime. There's crime everywhere. But it kind of speaks to this Midwestern imagination, the Midwest as a kind of innocent site and outside of other historical trends, or one that should be kind of immune from broader problems.
If you just joined us, my guest is Paul Morzycki. He's finishing up his PhD dissertation at the University of Iowa in the Department of History. He's a doctoral candidate, and he's looking at the well-known disappearances of Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin in the 1980s. These were teenage paperboys that disappeared. They're cold cases. They've never been solved. Putting in the context of the 1980s and how our society began to fear for our children in the Midwest, the reaction, and also the so-called milk carton kids. Gosch and Martin were the very first missing youngsters to be featured on milk cartons. You talked earlier about Reagan-era policies. So children have gotten lost, they've run away, they've been abducted throughout our history. What was it in society that set the 1980s apart to have this consolidate and make a real panic, a real fear in our society, this stranger danger?
Right. So this is happening right after or right during the so-called Reagan Revolution. Other folks have talked about a conservative counter-revolution, or, you know, in some ways a backlash to many of the social movements of the mid-20th century. So folks are envisioning themselves, specifically folks in the suburbs, white middle-class folks in the suburbs are envisioning themselves as somewhat of a silent majority, which is a term that, you know, Richard Nixon utilizes, and also that scholars have really emphasized and explored. So it fits within this broader worldview of a kind of suburban homeowner ethos, right? The idea that folks who live out in the suburbs are really, you know, to use Paul Ryan formulation, makers, and others are takers, really. And this isn't just applicable to tax policies, but also to generally kind of contributing to society. So, you know, speaking very generally, and I don't want to lump everybody in to this, but this idea of children being endangered by moral threats or so-called moral threats, whether that be abduction, molestation, exploitation, what have you, that notion is very much consistent with people's anxieties about larger social changes. So feminism, civil rights, gay rights, these different forces for many kind of spell or suggest a kind of deterioration of the family and of the nation more broadly, of the kind of moral fabric of the country.
So these abductions, these disappearances were seen as linked to what people interpreted as moral decay.
Absolutely. Right. So to take Noreen Gosch, she is often, again, this is Johnny Gosch's mother, she's oftentimes in the early 80s talking about how sexual liberation has kind of gone awry and has contributed to Johnny Gosch's disappearance and those of other children across the country. And the cases that generate the most publicity are those presumed to be stranger abductions, even though stranger abductions are incredibly rare in the United States and elsewhere. The most recent studies suggest that anywhere from 100 to 300 children are abducted by strangers or so-called strangers in any given year in the entire United States, which is a very, very low number. But these are the cases that generate the most attention. And the kind of central irony here is that a child is much more likely to be kidnapped by a parent or a family member or a close acquaintance, or to be sexually assaulted or otherwise abused by a parent or someone they know than they are by a stranger. And yet people are kind of positioning the family as under threat from outside or external forces, whether those are sexual liberationists or feminists or gay rights activists or environmental activists. A lot of folks are, and Noreen Gosch, this is evident in her rhetoric as well. She is kind of pointing to the fact that there are all these different campaigns. You know, she's kind of painting with a very broad brush, but saying that there are Save the Whales, Save the Seals, Save the Walruses, what have you, campaigns. And really there's nothing, at least in her view, to kind of stem the tide of strangers snatching children for nefarious purposes. So, again, this is a kind of positioning of child safety activists and bereaved parents positioning themselves against these kind of boogeymen who are ostensibly threatening their children and, by extension, the children of all virtuous, good, tax-paying, home-owning citizens.
As we mentioned, Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin became the first missing youngsters featured on milk cartons. You looked at the milk carton phenomenon. How did it come to pass that missing children's photos were put on milk cartons and also other consumer products?
Early on, as missing children, which as a phrase kind of becomes coined as we now know it, I think in around 1981 or so, immediately as this issue is gaining steam, folks in the private sector are responding and kind of demonstrating their commitment to the safety of children. And this is seen as a very kind of easy way to show that companies are family-friendly or interested in the well-being of families and American children. So missing kids photographs begin to appear on a lot of consumer items in public spaces. Before the milk carton campaign kicks off in late 1984 and then really gains steam in early 1985, you see missing children's photographs on television public service announcements, both on national channels and also local affiliates, on grocery bags, in newspaper ads, in New York City, you see them on throughway tickets, and in Chicago, you see them on public transit, on buses. And in 84, really, it's Anderson Erickson, after the Eugene Martin case, that decides to become involved and takes its cues from these other instances of putting missing kids' photographs on consumer items and in public spaces. And so they decide, we'll dedicate one side panel to these two kids, whose disappearance has really riveted Iowans. And this occurs with a little fanfare in Iowa. It really isn't until Anderson Erickson Dairy that begins this program, and Prairie Farms Dairy soon thereafter. Both of those, if I'm not mistaken, are located in Des Moines. And it's only when Hawthorne Melody, which is a now defunct dairy in Illinois, which distributes a lot or distributed a lot of milk to parts of the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota. That company harnesses this program, and it gains national attention. You see it on the nightly news. The New York Times runs stories about it, various other news outlets, and it explodes in popularity.
Does it explode in popularity because it's effective or for other reasons?
There's very little evidence to suggest that this brings children home in any substantive way. And many folks, including Benjamin Spock, this very famous, is he a psychologist or a psychiatrist, or maybe a pediatrician, but this Benjamin Spock, who has this very kind of outsized impact on people's thinking regarding children and child rearing, he sees this as counterproductive and frightening for children, and he's one of many experts who articulate that. And there really isn't a good deal of evidence that suggests that any children were returned in any kind of substantive way. Mm-hmm. There were probably a few, but very, very little to suggest, especially when you compare with how widely this program reached. At its, all told, something like 3 to 5 billion, with a B, milk cartons were distributed across the country. Up to 700 dairies participated in this program. The National Child Safety Council endorses this program, and really, again, all the nightly news programs and major newspapers run stories on this. So I don't think it's because of the efficacy, because there's really no suggestion that there, or no evidence to suggest that it was very effective. It was probably, and this is me kind of postulating here, that it had a lot to do with the symbolic resonance of milk cartons, and also the out of which the program came. So the fact that it's a Midwestern program, the fact that milk is so deeply linked, I think, to the Midwest and the upper Midwest and to a kind of agrarian pastoral tradition, and the kind of familial significance of the milk carton, the fact that milk is supposed to nurture children and help them grow, and it is consumed in these familial, safe spaces around the kitchen table. And there's this kind of tension between those comforting feelings and the fact that this supposedly comforting, generative item is carrying the images of children who may have met the most kind of heinous fates that one can imagine. And children are literally staring these kids in the face, and it spawns in people the suggestion that, hey, this could happen to me.
In just a moment, more of my conversation with the University of Iowa graduate student in history, Paul Morzycki, about the Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin cases from the 1980s, and about the politics of child safety in the late 20th century, the focus of Morzycki's dissertation. Then I talk with Special Agent Michael Motzinger of Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation about the newly formed Child Abduction Response Team. That's when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, I talk with Special Agent Michael Motzinger of Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation about the newly formed Child Abduction Response Team. But first, more of my conversation with the University of Iowa graduate student in history, Paul Morzycki, about the Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin cases from the 1980s, and about the politics of child safety in the late 20th century. That's the focus of his dissertation. So Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin, both photogenic, good-looking young men, white skin, a black-skinned youngster, not as likely to receive much attention?
It seems that way. in my research in looking through all these newspaper articles and television news coverage, there really isn't any evidence that there are specific individual African-American children who kind of sit at the forefront of this movement. I mean, really the faces that we remember now and that really were talked about at the time were Eitan Pate, Johnny Gosch, Eugene Martin, Adam Walsh. It's interesting at the, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, it's almost exclusively boys that generate all this tension. And within all these cases, even though in most instances there's no evidence to suggest any type of homosexual motive, that always kind of comes to the fore. And there isn't this vitriolic anti-gay rhetoric being deployed, but certainly you can sense this kind of anxiety either out in the open or kind of in a more subliminated way.
We still have missing children today that garner a lot of attention, and rightly so. The deaths of 10-year-old Lyric Cook and the 8-year-old Elizabeth Collins still being investigated. Today we have Amber Alerts, a child abduction alert system of recent years that gets the word out to radio, TV, email, social media very quickly. I wonder if with the changes perhaps in technology or since then in our society, whether our sense of safety for our children has changed and why.
In terms of technology, in the Missing Children and Child Safety campaigns, there's always this reliance and an emphasis and faith in technology. Really from the early 80s, folks are talking about how fingerprinting and computer software can help track down children, or how various databases, either federally run or state run, might help locate missing children. They're discussing how television as a medium enables folks to kind of reach into living rooms and spread the word about a missing child, and in some cases recover that child. Later, as computer software advances, there is this emphasis on how children's image can be modified. You know, if a kid goes missing when he or she is six, there is age enhancement or age progression software that suggests that he or she looks like this, you know, at the age of 30 or what have you. In cases of children that have been missing for quite some time, and this extends to today, from Amber Alerts to sex offender registries, which are readily available online. There is this faith in technology, but I think it all kind of also suggests that we're obscuring the threats that face children. You know, to suggest that a sex offender registry is going to somehow protect kids on a large scale, I think, is not necessarily rooted in fact. Or, you know, there is, I think, this constant trend of using children's names, whether they be Megan Conca or Jacob Wetterling or Johnny Gosch. There's a Johnny Gosch bill in Iowa, or Adam Walsh, using their names to kind of pass legislation that is, some would say, draconian, but almost unassailable. So using technology to police and restrict certain activities while also obscuring or, preventing people from maybe looking at other, maybe more systemic problems that face children that are far more pervasive, whether they be hunger or poverty or educational inequity, or something like car crashes, where many more children die in automobile accidents than they do at the hands of strangers in any given year. So yes, of course, Amber Alerts lend themselves to really heroic or triumphant stories, and people love to hear these stories of recovery. But they also, I think, do a disservice to children and to parents and to folks more broadly by suggesting that these are the things that we need to worry about and look out for. When of course, yes, there's always that possibility, but it is so slight when compared to others that that we should perhaps reevaluate.
So when we talk about reaction to this, society's reaction, but also politicians, what was the reaction to this fear from the Gosch, the Martin cases, and other cases from lawmakers in Iowa and across the country?
You know, and initially, I think there is maybe hesitance or reticence on the part of federal officials to get involved in this sort of matter, and certainly from on the part of Justice Department officials who kind of see this as a local matter, you know, the cases of missing children. And this actually works in many ways to the advantage of child safety activists who I think are very much riding anti-statist, anti-government sentiment that's widespread in the U.S. at this time, as folks, you know, folks' faith in the government has plummeted since the 1960s, you know, in the wake of the Vietnam War and Watergate. They really see the government as ineffectual or, you know, even worse, as callous and not interested in acting on their behalf. So activists like John Walsh and Noreen Gosch are saying, you know, these our national priorities and our governmental priorities are totally out of whack. You know, folks are more concerned about environmental activism than they are about the welfare of children. So federal officials, I think, initially don't really know what to think. And quite frankly, their priorities are kind of focused elsewhere. The economy is not doing very well. There are quite a few other concerns that I think outweigh this, right? But child safety activists find a way to kind of harness that anti-statist sentiment and to, again, kind of distort the nature of this problem by creating this idea of missing children, or this larger kind of term of missing children, which is very slippery, but also which suggests stranger abduction, even though within or under the umbrella of missing children, you have parental abductions, you have runaway children, which constitute the overwhelming majority of missing children. You have acquaintance abductions or thrown away children, you know, folks who I guess we would classify as either orphans or, you know, folks who have been abandoned by their guardians. So, you know, they kind of, with great aplomb, I think, use that term and use the idea of governmental ineptitude or inaction to get their way and to get legislation passed on the federal level in 1982 and 1984 with the Missing Children Act and the Missing Children's Assistance Act, respectively, in those 2 years. And again, you know, this makes for a great theater when it comes to the news media, and the news media very much seizes upon this and you know, takes a lot of close-ups of crying parents and takes a lot of glee, I think, in the fact that Justice Department officials are saying, well, you know, this isn't really something that we can do, or we, you know, we aren't the folks that should be addressing this problem. This should be ameliorated on the local level and the state level. But that obviously doesn't sit well with a lot of folks, and the news media very much exploits that. So eventually there are a lot of social conservatives who get on board with this campaign and who, again, position it within this longer or larger kind of list of grievances that people have about, you know, the American way of life as under threat. So it's not only missing children, but child pornography, obscenity laws, various kind of issues within this family values canon. And Reagan and others talk about how they are interested in protecting the American family. And when they're saying that, they're talking about missing children or providing tax relief to certain folks, to certain families. But they're not talking about kind of systemic, more structural or material circumstances. So there's this interesting kind of, I think, political back and forth, but ultimately Reagan does find a way to position himself within this child safety movement, which in some ways is still very much evident today, as you suggested in your previous question, with Amber Alerts and sex offender registries. These are all these all stem from this historical moment.
Paul Morzycki, thank you very much for this conversation. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben, for having me.
Paul Morzycki is a University of Iowa graduate student in history, looking back at the politics of child safety in the late 20th century. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For the remainder of the hour, let's bring this discussion of missing children, children's safety, into the present. In response to the recent abductions and murders of Elizabeth Collins and Lyric Cook Morrissey in Evansdale, also the abduction and murder of Kathleen Shepherd in Dayton, Iowa, the Iowa Department of Public Safety has formed what it's calling a child abduction response team. It goes by the acronym CART. And joining us to talk about its duties and its training, Michael Motzinger, special agent in charge of CART for the Division of Criminal Investigation at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Agent Motzinger, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben, for having me.
How will this team potentially do a better job than we've had in the recent past?
Yeah, Ben, basically, this is kind of a result of, obviously, the Evansdale and the Dayton double abductions. What we're trying to do is get a state of Iowa child abduction response team put together. And basically, it will help get more boots on the ground faster. And with, you know, Evansdale and Dayton, a lot of times if these do happen in the more rural areas, you know, it's hard to get a lot of manpower because those departments don't have a lot of people to begin with. And forming this CART team will help assist get more police departments, sheriff's offices involved to respond to help each other when a child does go missing.
Mm-hmm. So describe what in terms of personnel and equipment will be deployed. What will it look like?
Yeah, what the CART team will do, Ben, is we'll have a it's going to be broken up by regions. We'll have six different regions. That region will respond first to see if it is a true abduction. If it is, then they'll call and we'll get the entire CART team response, which will entail the state of Iowa bringing a trailer that basically has everything we need to set up a command center anywhere, really. We just need a big room. And what that'll do is help relieve a lot of the pressure off the local dispatch centers. We'll have everything we need to basically run the investigation out of this mobile command center. And then by doing that, we'll bring in everybody that will take part in the investigative side of it, the search side of it, the logistics side. And it's truly a team concept because one department can't fill all the roles that are needed to be filled when a child does go missing. So by having this CART team set up, it'll just bring quicker organization to an event and more boots on the ground and hopefully bring that child back safely to their family.
Mm-hmm. How long before this new team, this CART, is in place, ready to go?
Yeah, right now we're ready to respond. We don't have as many people as I would like at this time throughout the state. We're continuing to recruit people for that. We have had training back in February on the canvassing and search and recovery aspect of a child abduction. In May, we had another training in the Des Moines area, and that covered the investigative functions of a child abduction. And this September, we're going to have training in the Waterloo area that'll cover the basic forensics information that you need when a child goes missing. So we're bringing in training through the Amber Alert program. Iowa so we can get more officers and deputies trained in this type of function, because luckily it's not something that occurs on a daily basis. But you do need to prepare and be ready for when one does occur. And so we're trying to bring the training to Iowa to get more people trained quicker, so when something does happen, we'll be able to respond to that.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about the two tragic tragic cases that we've had in the news, but you experience every one of these that happens, the missing children. How often does this happen, or how often would this special new team, you think it would be likely that it would be called to action in a year or so? So,
yeah, anytime obviously a child goes missing, we encourage the local families. We're trying to get word out that you don't have to wait to report your child missing. Contact law enforcement right away. Trying to get law enforcement to realize if they do suspect that the child was abducted, to call right away so we can get more people there, boots on the ground a lot quicker, a lot earlier. So luckily, I mean, we had the two double abductions kind of back-to-back within a 10-month time frame, but then, we hadn't had any since then. And previous to that, maybe once or twice a year where you would actually have a full child abduction response. So luckily they're not things that occur on a daily or even a monthly basis, but when they do occur, everything better be organized, and they are a big item that happens. It's a big event, and local law enforcement and sheriff's offices quickly get overwhelmed on the scope that these and size that these can grow to.
We spoke with a guest earlier in the program. I think you heard part of that conversation about the anxiety over what's been termed stranger danger that swept Iowa and the country, and the disappearances of several children, also Iowans Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin in the 1980s. Remind us, how likely is it that perfect strangers abduct a child compared to someone that child knows, a family member, for instance?
Yeah, luckily, the studies, there are about 100 to 200 across the United States every year that are the true stranger danger. So families out there, when they're talking to their children, not only need to prepare them for the stranger danger, but also, come up with some type of password that only the parent and the child knows, that because a lot of them, they may be associates of the family that know the child, and, they could come up and say, hey, your mom and dad told me to come pick you up today.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by establishing some type of, password or whatever, and if that person doesn't know it, the child knows not to go with that person. So not only does the family, have to prepare their children for the stranger danger, but they also got to prepare them for, the family, acquaintances and friends. It's not just the stranger danger that parents have to, inform their kids and educate them about.
Is there a place that listeners can go to find out details on how to prepare and to talk to children about this in a more comprehensive way?
Yeah, we have a missing persons clearinghouse through the Department of Public Safety, and they team up with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they're based in the Washington, D.C. area in Virginia. And they have a lot of materials, parents, relatives, family, they can all go online, and they have pamphlets and brochures and different areas they can search under. A lot of it's free information. They can download that information, and then they have videos that children can watch that helps parents relate to the kids and teach them about not only stranger danger, but just all the dangers that are out there facing our children today.
Mm-hmm. We have a minute or so left, Agent Motzinger, but you've been personally involved in some of these cases. It must take a significant emotional toll on you to see children abducted.
It's a very big emotional toll, not only on me, but any officer or any of the volunteers really that get involved in a case such as Evansdale or Dayton. It's tragic, when you get to the end and find that the children have been killed. But just being able to find the children and bring those children home for the parents just so they have some closure. I'm not saying CART's going to bring every child home successfully, but obviously that's our goal. But it does take just a huge emotional toll anytime a child's involved. You take it personally. You go home, you think about it. You sleep, you think about it. You know, you go back and you work another 16, 18-hour shift. It stays with you all the time, and you're constantly thinking about it. And I know there's a lot of officers out there and deputies that, you know, always take these types of cases personally.
Thank you very much, Agent Michael Motzinger, in charge of the Child Abduction Response Team for the Division of Criminal Investigation at the Iowa Department of Public Safety. Agent Motzinger, thank you for talking with us.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, killer asteroids. Could it really happen to Earth? We'll find out tomorrow. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.